Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week in the news, a tax deal done, brave talk on Afghanistan, and the WikiLeaks mastermind walks half free. Last night, an $801 billion tax bill passed the House. Lots of Democrats against, some Republicans too.
On this vote, the yeas are 277, the nays are 148. The motion is adopted.
A big new White House report on Afghanistan is out, the assertion, progress. Here's the president.
This continues to be a very difficult endeavor, but I can report that thanks to the extraordinary service of our troops and civilians on the ground, we are on track to achieve our goals.
And Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks, is out on bail. He's got an ankle bracelet, no passport, and he claims a bullseye on him from a U.S. Justice Department looking to press charges.
Well, it's great to smell fresh air of London again.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for National Journal, Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Did the vote go your way on taxes? Do you believe we're on track in Afghanistan? Afghan vets, military, do you believe it? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's get right into the congressional side of this. Susan Davis, there's the deal last night. What do you make of the vote and how this all turned out?
Well, it definitely wasn't what Democrats wanted, that's for sure, at least not in the House. What you saw, once the Senate voted for 81 votes for this, I think it became very clear that there was no way Democrats in the House could oppose it, even if they wanted to. And Louise Slaughter, who's a Democrat from New York, a prominent member of the Liberal caucus, she called it, quote, a piece of crap, end quote. And I think that I think that sums up how a lot of the liberals in the House felt about it. But look at the vote. I mean, they had 270 Democrats in the House, 81 in the Senate. It may not have made – it may have divided the Democrats, but at the end of the day, that's a pretty overwhelming vote.
Jack Beatty, step back here. Eric Cantor, Republican House leader, saying we turn out to be better poker players than the president. What about the way all this unfolded, Jack?
Well, you know, you could argue that the president simply had no choice, and one of the reasons was the way the leaders of each house, the Democratic leaders, managed this. You know, this vote could have happened before the election. The election could have been about this. Should taxes go up be cut for 98% of the people or for all of them? That could have been the issue. But senators up for re-election didn't want to run on that. They feared that they'd be, you know, tarred with wanting to raise somebody's taxes. And Nancy Pelosi faced a rebellion from something like 30 or 40 blue dogs who were going to vote with the Republicans. So once that happened, essentially the calendar acted as a sort of Russian roulette, and the president had to act. But what I'm struck with here is the self-interest involved. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the median income of House members, median is $911,000 a year.
Okay.
And in the Senate, it's $2.3 million a year. These chaps just gave themselves huge tax cuts.
$911,000 median income in the House. I had thought they were the scrappy ones living five to a, you know, studio apartment in the backside of Washington.
Well, of course, you know, it's thrown off somewhat by people like Daryl Issa, who has a personal fortune of $300 million. Nevertheless, that's the figure.
Susan Davis, I'm still thinking about the poker game here, about how this might have gone. The November elections were huge in this. They gave Republicans big numbers and leverage because they are coming in. But could this have turned out differently? This was a big promise from President Obama in his campaign. You know, we're not going to keep giving tax cuts to the top of the income range, the very high top these days.
I think you're exactly right. I think Democrats in the who still currently control Congress in this lame duck felt that they could get more out of this deal. But when you look at Mitch McConnell in the Senate and Republicans in the House, their point is, we won this election. This was a referendum against the Democratic Party. So they felt zero need to negotiate to give the Democrats anything that they wanted on this. Their point was, we're about to come into control and, you know, we have all the cards are in our hands. I think, and this is going to be really interesting, obviously the White House, who agreed to the 2-year extension of the Bush tax cuts, they clearly want to have this fight in the president's reelection campaign. They think that this is a winnable argument, or at least a fight that can play to their advantage. I'm not necessarily sure I see that, in part because if he couldn't get it done when he enjoyed strong Democratic majorities in the House and Senate, and in the beginning of his term when he had very high approval ratings, I'm not sure why anyone can believe that he would be able to get it done in his second term, when I think reasonable people can agree that there's very little chance Democrats are going to take back the House in the next in the 2012 elections, and there's an even stronger possibility that Republicans could win the Senate in the 2012 elections.
Win the Senate, and then you're up against who knows what next time.
Exactly. And you don't know who the party's nominee is going to be yet. Mm-hmm. But I don't, especially because the other component of this is the people that are really angry by this is the liberal base. Right. So I think that they would look at the president, who in 2012 is going to say, I don't believe in these tax cuts. And he said that consistently. He said this in this deal. He said, I don't believe that this is right, but this is the best we can get. I'm not sure. If you're a liberal voter, you're going to look at him a second time and say, well, now I believe you.
Now,
I think that
there's
a suspicion there. And the White House calculation, I believe, is that they think the liberal base of the Democratic Party will come back into the fold, at the very least, because they're certainly not going to vote for whoever the Republican nominee for president
is. Hold the thought. I want to get our listeners in here. Tom in Owosso, Michigan. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. I really think this is the worst possible bill at the worst possible time. We can't afford it. He did half a job with the unemployed people. Where's something for the 99ers? We're getting another 40,000 of those next few months here in Michigan. What are they supposed to do?
99ers? What are 99ers, Tom?
99ers are, I'm amazed. I have to explain this every time. Everyone should know. 99ers are people who have exhausted there are 99 weeks of unemployment.
And in Michigan, you know that too well, yeah.
Yeah, Tier 5 is what we've been trying to get, but it fell on its face. Nobody supported Stabenow's bill, and of course we didn't get any support in this one. No, this had no support for any of the people whose benefits had already been exhausted. What are they supposed to do, eat dirt?
Yeah, exactly. And you're calling and talking from a state that knows exactly what that pain is about. Let me get one more here. New Haven, Connecticut. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Hello. I was glad to see the president play some poker. I think that's what politics is all about. I was confused with the entire debate, though, at why everyone pinned the number at $250,000. I thought comparing someone who makes $250,000 a year compared to someone who makes $1 million a year is the same as comparing someone who makes $20,000 a year to someone who makes $80,000 a year.
Yeah.
On the East Coast, West Coast, $250,000 a year means public schools, scrimping for college, and all that. I would have liked to see him, you know, throw some more chips in there and move that figure up.
Well, that's interesting, Chris. I'm glad you raised that as well. Jack, I mean, talk about the poker game, just that it was based around $250,000. Now, if you're sitting there in Michigan or anywhere in this country and you're 99th week plus out of work, that looks like a fortune, but there are much, much bigger fortunes. I mean, how did that become the dividing line? Maybe if it had been, you know, $1 million plus in taxes, the tax cut doesn't get extended, the politics might have been different, Jack.
It might have been, and Chuck Schumer thought so, and he introduced an amendment a week ago that would essentially have done that, and it was voted down, and the White House didn't support it, and they didn't support it because the Republicans would have balked. And then it created real friction there. I mean, I quite agree. To say someone with $250,000, you know, a hardworking dentist is rich. I mean, if we see one thing in all this debate, it is we need new tax brackets. We need a bracket for the upper income people. You know, in the 1930s, the bracket was close to, you know, it was way up there, and we can do that again. I mean, it's and it creates an unnecessary kind of friction. I mean, people who are in a way just getting by are being called the rich.
But it's all going the other way now. And, of course, the Republicans coming in with a much bigger agenda to work on here. Democrats were worried about that last night. Here's Democratic Congressman Gerald Nadler of New York saying cutting those taxes will leave a hole in the budget, a hole, he said, that will give Republicans, you know, their way to slash social programs, he claims, next year. He voted against the bill. Here's Nadler.
It would generate a $700 billion increase in the deficit, which would make it almost impossible to fund housing, education, everything else we need. It would be the culmination of the 30-year Republican effort to starve the beast, to deliberately create huge deficits in order to provide the political cover.
Susan Glasser at Foreign Policy Magazine, you're listening patiently here. Countries all over the Western world, anyway, are dealing with budget deficits. How do you think Europe is going to look on at what the United States has just done when it comes to its fiscal situation, Susan Glasser?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. You certainly haven't yet seen the new politics of austerity really kicking in here in the U.S. And I think one of the interesting things will be the tension inside the new governing Republican majority in the House as they come in January, and to what extent they sort of fall in line with where Europe has gone, which is in a very hardline, budget-cutting, deficit-focused policy.
Does it look to you like the United States is getting real on the fiscal front, Susan Glasser, with this legislation?
It looks to me like President Obama is playing kick the can down the road, not only with the tax cuts, but I think you could argue that's what we saw in the Afghan policy review this week as well. Just a sort of, you know, I'm not in a strong position right now. This is the best deal I can make. This is the best assessment I can produce. And we're going to revisit it later down the road. I wonder politically about those decisions. It's hard to see that, as the other Susan mentioned, that the political situation is going to look better for him or stronger on this tax issue 2 years from now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Tax deal passed. Big Afghan report. A court rules against health care reform. Susan Glasser is with us, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for National Journal. Our own Jack Beatty is here. Response here online on the tax front from Kate says the Democrats, she says, the Democrats have just ensured that liberals stay home for the 2012 election. That is, unless the Republicans nominate Palin. We'll see. Lynn says, we passed another stimulus package this week. Good for us, and thank you, Mother China, for letting us borrow the credit card again, but I don't think she means it. Albert in Newbury, Massachusetts. Albert, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, as always, for the work that you guys do.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I'm very confused. You know, I grew up listening to my mother tell me stories about growing up during the Depression, where, you know, she didn't know what it meant to wear nylons, and they used to go around her neighborhood in Brooklyn collecting scrap metal. I don't see any of that kind of sacrifice being asked of the American people. I remember that we were told to go shopping after 9/11. I see people complaining about the price of gas, yet we're driving more and more and more. And now we've got a tax bill that just seems to put us even deeper in the hole. And aside from some kind of altruistic notion of American idealism, I don't see how we get out of this.
But Albert, you know, the argument is we need the stimulus effect in here is important to keep this rather weak, mild, recovery going.
Oh, I understand completely. I understand the politics of the situation. I understand that I've just been laid off again. And, you know, I just don't understand how we can't have some kind of collective sacrifice, you know, in America, especially with those at the very top who seem to be not sacrificing, but rather taking at a time when we need to be doing more as a country.
And you've got a layoff to deal with. Albert, our heart is with you. Yeah, we got to get it together here. Thanks for calling. Thomas in Waltham, Massachusetts. Thomas, you're on.
Hi. I'm really befuddled by the lack of strategy used by Obama. Each one of these issues, whether it was the estate tax, whether it was the extension of tax benefits to the very rich, whether it was a number of these things that came up and that he gave away on, he should have prayed that they opposed the reduction for the middle class. He should have prayed that they filibustered through the extension of unemployment claims. I mean, each one of these issues brought up separately, he could have flogged the Republicans with.
Well, so you say, but they won in November. Susan Davis wonders how it's going to play in 2012. We'll look at that. Thomas, thanks. One more. Dothan, Alabama. Jane is calling. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I'm confused about the Tea Party people. When they were running very strongly against the budget deficit. And now all of a sudden with this tax bill, they don't care about the deficit anymore. What's going on?
Let's go straight to that. Susan Davis, what about it? I mean, there were 30-plus Republican votes against this, along with disgruntled Democrats last night, and there have been plenty of Republicans saying that they don't like this deal. Where does the chemistry go around, you know, spending and budgeting as we get into this new Congress with a Republican majority in the House, Susan?
Well, to the caller's point, I do think it's worth mentioning that a lot of the Tea Party candidates that she is referencing haven't yet gotten to Congress. We're still in the lame duck session. And a lot of these members that she's in reference to, I think Rand Paul is probably a good example of that. They're not going to be sworn in until January. So
but
the dynamic is
they've got Republicans looking
shift.
Over their shoulders already, certainly.
Absolutely. And I do think there's another caller brought this up. I do think there's a certain intellectual, I don't want to say controversy, but, you know, last week we had the fiscal commission that the Obama administration appointed, and they came out and largely said, you know, this country, we're headed towards a cliff if we don't get our fiscal house in order. And then the next big act by Congress and the White House is to approve an $858 billion tax bill with some stimulus spending that isn't paid for. So I think that if the American people are looking at this and there's still this sense of anger that, you know, what is Washington going to do? When it comes to shared sacrifice, I will say that this is a term that I keep hearing a lot from members of Congress that are very mindful of budget. And one of those is Paul Ryan, a Republican from Wisconsin, who's going to be the House Budget Committee chairman. And he says, and he said recently, that he thinks the American public are ready for some shared sacrifice. And I look at in the Senate, senators like Tom Coburn and Jim DeMint, who actually voted against this package for that very reason, as they're saying, look, like this is, as you said, just kicking the can down the road.
Well, we've got all kinds of opinions here. Willis in Clarksville, Tennessee, saying he doesn't want to hear that $250,000 is not a lot of money. That's only 2% of Americans make that, he says. Let's go to Scotia, New York, and Barry. Barry, you're on the air.
Hi. I think something that's been overlooked in this, I personally don't think that spending money try and goose the economy is going to work, because I think there are sea changes in how American consumers spend their money, which I happen to think is a good thing. But a little notice feature of this is the fact that he's going to cut payroll taxes. That's a euphemism for the money that funds Medicare and Social Security. Other remarks Obama's made indicate that he is ready to buy into the argument that the way to balance the budget and reduce the deficit over the long run is to cut our so-called entitlement programs. I think he's decided these are expendable.
Really? You think the president has? We'll see about that when the next campaign comes.
Very clear. I think he's brought that argument from some of these commissions that have been going on, and the fact of the matter, Social Security has not contributed one penny toward the debt so far. In fact, it's been used to balance and reduce the deficit for the last 20 years.
Yeah, Barry, I appreciate your call. Susan Davis on that. The payroll tax cut is going to put cash in people's pocket for, is it 1 year, 2 years, Susan?
I believe, and I don't know if there's final ticker in the language, but I believe it's a 2 year.
But they're not presenting that as a way of pulling the plug on these programs. They're presenting it as a stimulus.
That's right. And this is another issue where I think Republicans got the advantage in this tax deal. This is not necessarily something that Democrats, they wanted a sort of alternative language in there on this same point. And this is another matter where Republicans said, hey, you know, line in the sand and we're not crossing it.
Let's go to that big Afghanistan report and exactly what it means. A sort of report on the strategy of the Obama administration in Afghanistan. Here was the president speaking yesterday at a press conference, saying that despite challenges, the Taliban is losing the fight in Afghanistan.
Progress comes slowly and at a very high price in the lives of our men and women in uniform. In many places, the gains we've made are still fragile and reversible. But there is no question, we are clearing more areas from Taliban control, and more Afghans are reclaiming their communities.
So there's the view. That's the big attitude in the White House. But that was, you know, the reversible and fragile was loud and clear in there as well. Susan Glasser, what do you make of this sort of midterm policy report?
Well, I think the cautious language reflects the White House's caution at this moment in time. What they're trying to do is to get through this report without it forcing any major political debate, without it forcing any new course correction. Of course, next summer is headed toward a big political discussion here in Washington on the question of the Obama troop surge into Afghanistan. He set a July 2011 time frame. He's already, and the military's already tried to kick that farther down the road, or to define what does it mean to begin the withdrawal process. But really what you're hearing when you hear the word fragile, what it means is we need to claim some progress, but we can't really say for sure whether it's lasting, whether it makes a difference. Remember, we're in the ninth year of the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. It's pretty hard to say with credibility over and over again every year that you're beating the Taliban.
I mean, I really don't get exactly what's going on here. Maybe there's some progress right now, but it's winter. Winter's when you don't have as much fighting. In any case, it's always the season for optimism in Afghanistan. But at the same time, even in the areas where they're saying Taliban's been cleared, you've got American news reporters over there, you know, showing us people who are deathly afraid even to speak to them. People still being assassinated if they work for the government in Kandahar, you know, farmers who won't talk to anybody because they're afraid the Taliban's looking over their shoulder. I mean, and the big issues, Pakistan next door, the legitimacy of the Karzai government, its credibility, nobody says those are resolved, Susan. What is this report really supposed to mean?
Well, I think that's a very important set of points you just made. For example, Pakistan, that's in many ways the big takeaway of the report, which is to say we acknowledge once again and in a significant way that without more aggressive cross-border operations into Pakistan, our strategy in Afghanistan is not going to work. We acknowledge that our supposed allies, the Pakistanis, have not taken the measures to cut off the support for al-Qaeda and the Taliban that comes from inside Pakistan, the Haqqani network. This is still supported by factions within the Pakistani government itself. They have not done what they have said they would do in terms of moving more aggressively against them. And frankly, if they don't do that, then the insurgency will keep going because it's being actively fueled by a state next door that has the resources to keep it going.
Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Randy, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Randy.
Tom, when I heard the Afghanistan report, I felt like I was in a time machine, going back to David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest, where the military and the government, political leaders and the Defense Department were misleading us about what was happening in Vietnam. The same thing is happening today in Afghanistan in regard to what's going on there and the prospects for the future. Read The Best and the Brightest.
Read it and see it played again. Let's look at that, Jack. I mean, Americans of a certain age might well feel that way this week. Is it a credible piece of deja vu?
If you just looked at the body language and sort of measured the affect of the speakers at the press conference the other day, Secretaries of Defense and State and the President, you could see they had no conviction in this. If they're trying to spin it, they were spinning it with sort of minimal energy, and they couldn't hide. And the leak of NIE documents earlier in the week wouldn't let them hide that the two pillars of the policy, the two contingencies everything depends upon, a responsive, effective Afghan government and a Pakistani government that's doing what we're paying them to do, getting after these, you know, clearing out these sanctuaries, that neither of those things are working. And of all things, this week the Washington Post had a piece on Monday reporting a conversation that President Karzai had with David Petraeus in October. And he told Petraeus and our ambassador, he now has three enemies, the Taliban, the United States, and the international community. And then he said, if I had to choose sides today, I'd choose the Taliban. That's our ally. That's the person we're trying to prop up. And on the Pakistan side, the silence and the euphemism that comes over, well, we're insisting, we're hoping. You know, when you think about it, in the Vietnam War, there were sanctuaries. We couldn't go north of the border to strike the Vietnam-Chinese border to strike at the supply lines. We couldn't strike at the Russian freighters in mm-hmm. Haiphong Harbor. Mm-hmm. That would have widened the crisis. Those were sanctuaries. We weren't paying the Chinese. We weren't paying the Russians. We're giving billions to the Pakistanis. We're paying the people who are protecting the forces that are killing our soldiers. It is an absurdity, and it's something that would only happen with a volunteer army where this idea of shared sacrifice, it's not us. We don't know anybody who's doing it. Not our kids involved. That's the feeling. And so you can do whatever you want with these forces.
But it is us, and those are real American kids fighting out there. Here's a hard-headed view we heard this week from retired Marine Colonel T.X. Hams, talking with NPR. He teaches at the National Defense University now. This was called a strategy report, but he looked at the big strategic pieces and was not so persuaded.
What do we think is going to change at the strategic level between now and 2014 that will translate this tactical success into some kind of strategic success? You go back to the two fundamental questions. Will Pakistan change in a major way by 2014? Will the Karzai government change the way it operates by 2014?
Susan Glasser, never mind 2011. I mean, there will be, we read, a debate over exactly how many troops come out, but everyone's assuming it's a minority, maybe a small minority of troops coming out. 2014 seems like the new real date, and even that seems unclear. I mean, what are we signed up for here? 9 years already? Is it another 9 years? 19 years? What do you see, Susan?
Well, that's the terrible peril, I think, that Obama's found himself in. I was really struck by your earlier caller pointing out, is this a best and the brightest moment? And I think your observation is right on the mark. They're not trying to spin this. They're acutely aware of that Vietnam analogy. They're acutely aware of the perils, and yet they're still trapped in it. I think that's what has made this such a painful thing to watch unfolding over the last two years for President Obama. He came in determined, of course, to be the un-Bush, right? Not only was he going to end the war in Iraq, but he was going to get it right in Afghanistan, is what he told us during the campaign, unlike President Bush. Also, he wasn't going to pretend that there was progress when there wasn't. And yet, nonetheless, this is very much now his war. You read that very painful account, I think, behind the scenes of the Obama White House in Obama's War, the Woodward book. And what do you see? You see Barack Obama personally crafting this painful compromise, in effect, with between his military and his White House staff to come up with the July 2011 date that is, in fact, already basically being mooted, and we're already talking about 2014. So it's Barack Obama's problem now, and no matter how many times he says, well, the gains are fragile, it's a split-the-difference consensus committee-driven process, right? So, you know, nobody's happy, basically, with what we're doing.
But Susan Davis, how do you read the politics here? I mean, Hillary Clinton, I heard her present this week as a life and death conflict for the United States. Well, if that's true, maybe you have to stay, but politics are always here. 2014, how does the president's team read that in terms of re-election strategy?
One of the things, and Susan referenced this when she said, you know, this is the ninth year of this war, which is sort of it's stunning when you think about how long the U.S. engagement has been. And the thing, but from the politics of it, I do think it's a testimony to how much the economy looms over everything else in this country right now, to the fact that I don't see Afghanistan. I'm surprised that Afghanistan is not a bigger issue than it is among the American public. Pew, a very reputable polling outfit, put out a poll this week on Afghanistan that shows that the American public sentiment on the war and on their assessment of the war hasn't changed in the past 6 months.
But I saw 60% by one account that are not hopeful about the war.
Right. I think that there's this sort of stagnation where they don't think we're going to win, but they believe that we should. They're committed to the U.S. cause over there. A couple dynamics in Washington that I do think are interesting is, one, you are going to have Republicans in greater influence next year. And this first 6 months of next year, I do think we're going to see an increase of conversation. But also David Petraeus. He's a person that has, I think, a strong amount of goodwill, both from the White House and from Congress. So it's going to be hard to disagree with what Petraeus wants, I think, is what I'm saying.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, eldest son of disgraced financier Bernie Madoff, Mark Madoff, dead by suicide. Here's a New York neighbor.
As far as Mark is concerned, you know, obviously there's no real basis for judgment as to whether or not he was involved, but I guess now, case closed. Sad.
CNN's Larry King signed off last night after a quarter century of suspenders and celebrities and interviews.
I don't know what to say except to you, my audience. Thank you. And instead of goodbye, how about so long?
And the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inducted Alice Cooper this weekend, Tom Waits, Neil Diamond, Leon Russell, and Darlene Love. Here's her Christmas Baby Please Come Home, 1963. We're looking at a week in the news with Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine. Susan Davis of the National Journal. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. What do you think? Will health care reform survive the courts? Will Julian Assange end up in American prison? Will gays in the military be the way it is? Tomorrow we'll look at what's coming on that vote. And what are you thinking about the Madoff son dead, about the shooter and the Florida school board, the avalanche at the Metrodome, Larry King, Richard Holbrook. Buffalo, New York. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Calling about Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
And this appears to be Vietnam all over again. As we know, Al-Qaeda is not in Afghanistan. They're in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. Are we going to invade those countries? I don't think so. It's an unwinnable war.
There's a piece of American attitude right there, right in the face of this report. Peter, thanks. One more. Attico, North Carolina. Grady, you're on the air, Grady.
Hey, thank you. The three topics that you've had today are excellent on the tax breaks, the budget, and the war. And we're a country that is in war. We're not paying for it. And we have a budget deficit, and we're giving ourselves tax breaks. And as Jack said earlier, we have no skin in this game. And if your panelists would just speak about the fact that we're not paying for it and how they see that playing out in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Grady. Susan Davis, do you see any, pulling back from Afghanistan because of the cost of this war, which is high?
I think you will definitely see that among Democrats in Congress next year, and potentially from some Republicans, particularly this Tea Party wave that is coming into Congress. An interesting element of a lot of the candidates that identified with the Tea Party movement is that they are very fiscally conservative, but when it comes to foreign policy, they lean more towards Ron Paul is what I think of as someone who is against sort of foreign engagements on almost across the board and has opposed the war in Iraq. And you are going to have this element. I don't think it's going to be a majority of the Republican Party, obviously, but I do think you're going to have a growing number of Republicans who just fundamentally disagree with what has been largely a conservative foreign policy over the past 10 years. So it's going to add an interesting element into this debate.
I want to turn to WikiLeaks. Julian Assange out of jail in London, but still talking about jail looming over him. He's got an ankle bracelet, sort of electronically tracked, having to check in every single day, no passport. What do you call it? Something like high-tech house arrest. Here he is saying that he thinks the U.S. Justice Department is still gunning for him.
We have a rumor today from my lawyers in the United States. It's not confirmed yet that there has being an indictment made against me in the United States.
Susan Davis, first, any evidence on that front? They're talking about a secret grand jury in Washington working on something. People talk about the Espionage Act of 1917 being thrown against him. He is not out of control of authorities, that's for sure. Is there anything known about what the Department of Justice may or may not be doing here?
I don't know about the Department of Justice, but I think it is fair to say that the United States is looking at their options. I mean, even this week on Capitol Hill, the Judiciary Committee hosted a hearing specifically on the WikiLeaks matter and if and how they could prosecute on this matter. I do think that one thing that people agree on is that the statutes largely under the Espionage Act of 1917 are completely out of date for the modern world. And Abby Lowell, who's sort of a famous Washington attorney, testified before them and said that the law is so flawed and it would be so difficult to probably prosecute anyone under modern standards under this law, and that there seems to be an agreement that it needs to be reformed and modernized, but maybe controversy isn't always the best reasons to do it under.
Susan Glasser, how's this looking internationally? We talked yesterday with John Perry Barlow, sort of cyber libertarian and former director of national intelligence, John Negroponte, a real divergence of view over where rights are going here and what's right, where this ought to go. I mean, if Julian Assange stays with an ankle bracelet or deeper in custody, is that the end of this or are we just getting going?
Well, first of all, I mean, listen, you know, you have a congressional hearing. What does that seem like? In the end, it seems probably not only to people in Europe, but to a lot of people here in the United States as well as just more grandstanding. You're talking about a nearly century-old act that is almost certainly unconstitutional, according to most of the serious scholars who've looked at it, if it were to be applied in a case like this. I think the Justice Department would be unlikely to risk its credibility making an indictment under the Espionage Act for that reason. Once again, of course, that does put Eric Holder in a significant bind. You have the American political class pretty predictably braying for Julian Assange's head. He seems almost a figure out of a cartoon imagining of a 21st century cyber villain. And I think that dilemma is going to hang over us increasingly in coming years, whether it's Assange or others like him. We're dealing in a world of data and information unlike any we've ever imagined. At the same time, what is the real impact of WikiLeaks been? Well, to start, I don't think we actually know. But on the other hand, I don't think the earth has opened up and sort of swallowed American diplomacy whole. You know, there's some truth to what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said when the first week when they came out. She said, you know, I got a very sympathetic response from one of my foreign minister colleagues. He said, you should see what we write about you. And I think there has been an element of, okay, we can deal with this in terms of what the actual impact has been. So I would be very surprised if we see Julian Assange ever dragged here to the United States and you know, sent to Gitmo or something like that. It's not going to happen.
Interesting. While we're on U.S. diplomacy, one final thought on Afghanistan. Richard Holbrooke, dead this week after a very big career, tough negotiator, tough as nails on many fronts, long, long service in the State Department. Do you see it, Susan Glasser, making a difference in American strategy, policy, what effectiveness in Afghanistan, Pakistan, with this big name envoy gone?
You know, someone said this week that Richard Holbrooke was in a job that just wasn't ready for him. And I think that's a lot of what we've been talking about today in terms of Afghanistan. People wanted desperately for us to be in an endgame, for there to be a role for a master American negotiator who could step in and cut a deal. Mm-hmm. But the very sad truth is that Richard Holbrooke wasn't even negotiating with anybody because there wasn't anybody yet to negotiate with. The time for peace, no matter how much we wish for it, is not yet at hand in Afghanistan. And what's so tragic in the end, right, is that this figure in Holbrooke spanned the history of American diplomacy from Vietnam to Afghanistan. This was a guy, as with his president, eyes wide open, right? His early career was in Vietnam. He was out in the field. He was a foreign service officer in Saigon during the war. He was a very junior staffer during the peace talks in Paris for Vietnam. Flash forward several decades to his role in Afghanistan. He, too, aspired to bring together the best and brightest minds in the U.S. to think about Afghanistan and Pakistan. But just because he had assembled that brain power, just because of his own formidable brain power, didn't mean that he could get people in a room and knock their heads together as he did with Dayton and produce a peace accord. He wasn't even there yet.
Well, let's hope we can get the big strategic poker right on that front. Iowa City, Iowa. Joseph, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Joseph.
I wanted to speak about the healthcare system.
Yes, sir.
Debate.
Yes.
I'm 54 years old, and I've been in this country all my life. And I think this country needs to go back to basics when it comes to the healthcare. We all, as Americans, have to remember that we built this country taking care of ourselves, defending ourselves. And the thing that's going around about this about healthcare, that about healthcare, you know, we should remember greed is not the way. And that's what it's all about. If you can't afford it, you can't afford it because you have to feed your family, you know.
So what do you want, Joseph, when you look around the world? Do you like our system? Do you want some other kind of system? What are you looking for?
No. I'm looking for the way, I think it's Sweden, the way they do. They have health care for every citizen. You know, our country is a good country. It's a vast country, and I believe if we get away from wanting this and wanting that and get back to basics, then I think all of us can live with the fact that we can take care of each other.
Joseph, I appreciate your call very much. Healthcare and looking there for healthcare for all back to basics in that sense of taking care of one another. Susan Davis, it kind of went the other way this week with the ruling in Virginia. I mean, we've got a comment here on Facebook from Nate saying, you know, on the Virginia health care insurance ruling, if it's unconstitutional to require health insurance, that is for all, does that mean I can cancel the auto policy I'm forced to buy? Joseph wants it for everybody, but with this court ruling, are we leaning the other way, Susan Davis?
Well, I would say to the Facebook commenter that you have to have car insurance, but the government doesn't tell you you have to have a car, which is the difference between the two mandates. I don't think there's any doubt at this point that this is going to end at the Supreme Court. I would say, though, that obviously the talk this week is about the most recent judge ruling in, out of Virginia, who was a appointee under President George W. Bush, so there's some implied politics in his ruling as well. But it's important to remember that opponents of the health care bill there's been about two dozen court cases filed against it. About half of them have been dismissed. And in a couple of them, the judge ruled that the law is explicitly constitutional. So I think that there's a wide variety of legal disagreement out there, which I think is almost ensuring that this is on a path to the Supreme Court. If it were at the end of the day to rule that the individual mandate was unconstitutional and voided the law, it would essentially completely unravel the law as it is. Because I think regardless of how you feel about the law, there is agreement that the only way you can cover all citizens is to require all citizens to pay into the system.
Jack Beatty, can you imagine what it would mean to see this whole thing after all these years unraveled in front of the Roberts Court?
Oh, you know, and you don't it's hard, you can't predict these things, but I can imagine at least three votes against it on that court, and it could well come down to Anthony Kennedy. It's a roll of the dice. And this week there were some stories about the White House thinking, well, what would we do if we didn't, you know, what would be the sort of legal equivalent of the individual mandate if it falls down? But, you know, when you look at Judge Hudson's reasoning in this decision, which has come under criticism from conservatives as sloppy and not really up to the mark. I mean, he argues that Congress under the Commerce Clause doesn't have the power to regulate economic inactivity, that is, the decision not to get health insurance. And yet, when you look at it, that decision has economic consequences. $43 billion a year is the cost of uncompensated care in emergency rooms and hospitals. That's all because people aren't insured. And who pays for that? We do. It's something like $1,000 per insurance policy to pay for the uninsured. That's why the administration, in a piece of euphemism, is calling it not the individual mandate, but the, quote, individual responsibility provision. It's very hard to argue that this inactivity doesn't have economic consequences.
A couple of other big ones right there in Congress as the clock ticks down on this session. The START treaty. Susan Glasser, the Obama administration has been pushing hard here. There was pushback. Does it look like this might be done before everybody goes home for the holidays?
Well, might is a good word right now. It's been an extraordinarily and surprisingly tough road for this new START treaty in the end. Most of the experts who looked at the deal that the Obama administration cut with Russia sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, you know, it's fine for what it is. It's not necessarily a huge, significant paradigm-changing breakthrough. Nonetheless, Republican opposition has been significant enough to stall it, to have this take much longer than expected. I think there are some encouraging signs. Not only has the floor debate in the Senate begun this week on the START treaty, there's a sense that they need 9 Republicans. They're probably going to get that, but, you know, not one more. So we'll see in the final days, but it's very close to call. There's no margin for error on the Obama administration's effort to get this treaty passed.
Susan Davis, how are you counting heads on the nuclear front here with START? Are there enough GOP votes emerging to push that through?
I think there is. I think what we saw earlier this week, the test vote on it, and they got 66 votes, and Evan Bayh, the Democrat from Indiana, was not there for it, and he's presumably would vote for the treaty. So I think they'll get there. I think that this week has also proved that a senator of consequence and one to keep your eye on is John Kyle of Arizona. He has been fundamental both in negotiating the tax deal with the White House, but also being a real thorn in their side on the START treaty. And I think he's someone that is going to be someone to be watched in the next Congress.
Jack, what about on the don't ask, don't tell front? Might that be repealed imminently here? What does that headcount look like?
It looks like it's going to happen tomorrow. History will be made tomorrow. Scott Brown, the Massachusetts senator, is the 60th vote, and I think he yesterday he said that he would vote to repeal.
Susan, is it clear what that's going to mean for policy? Gays in the military, if there's no don't ask, don't tell, is it policy instantly, or is there a runway of years before it's implemented? Is it clear?
It's not 100% clear yet, but the Pentagon has been actively preparing for this, and so they would be in a position to pretty quickly roll out what their plan will be for dealing with this. My prediction is that a year from now, we won't even remember this, that it's been vastly overblown for nearly two decades now as a political issue in the U.S. If you look at other militaries around the world, militaries are pretty conservative in many societies. A vast majority of our allies have figured out how to deal with this without it being something that rips the society apart. My guess is that we will be able to sort of overcome this much more quickly than the political and chattering classes imagine.
Susan Glasser, we've just got 20 seconds here. The Global View, you've got it at Foreign Policy Magazine. How do you think the world will react if and when, maybe tomorrow, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed?
I think they'll say, oh, it's about time, huh?
Well, that would be some slight end to a very, very long debate in this country. Wow. Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief at Foreign Policy Magazine, joining us today from Washington. It's been great to have you. Thank you very much for being with us, Susan.
Thank you.
And Susan Davis at National Journal, congressional correspondent there. Susan Davis, thanks to you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack, here we go. Enjoy the weekend. Thanks for being with us, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.